Unless you have both relatively equal gender norms and decent rule of law, then female entrepreneurship is very low. The gap's really quite large.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Faced with a business environment that allows male violence and male expropriation as well, it would be no surprise if women decided that becoming an entrepreneur, well, it wasn't worth the risk. So does this describe the situation in developing countries? And if so, what can we do about it? Nava Ashraf of the London School of Economics and Ed Glaser of Harvard are two of the authors of a new working paper that investigates the problems for female entrepreneurs when the rule of law is weak. Nava, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Great to be here.
And I'm delighted to have you here, Nava, seeing as you are actually on the road somewhere near Vancouver, aren't you?
Yes, exactly.
Well, that'll explain any traffic noise.
Female entrepreneurs on the go.
And Ed, welcome as well.
Thank you so much for having me on, Tim. It's great to be here.
Nava, how male-dominated is entrepreneurship in developing countries?
So as you said, Tim, entrepreneurship as a whole is highly male-dominated. So more than two men select into entrepreneurship for every female entrepreneur globally, for every nascent female entrepreneur. And in developing countries, it's an interesting dynamic because it's also male-dominated, but because so much of female entrepreneurship in developing countries is more about subsistence type of entrepreneurship, it is a little bit more equal. So in 2016, the female-to-male ratio in entrepreneurial activity was about 0.7, for example, in South Africa, 0.8 in Botswana, around 0.4 in Tunisia or Egypt. And already in those descriptives, you can start to see some of what comes out in our paper, which is the role of gender norms and rule of law in this. But in general, it's quite a male-dominated activity. And then within entrepreneurship, as we'll talk about, it's very male-dominated which sectors women go into.
You also point out that female entrepreneurs tend to choose sectors to work in where other women are working as well. Why is this happening?
And what we're thinking about, in particular in developing countries, are tailoring, food. You can see this also in developed countries, actually. Mm. Often there's a clustering. And the reason that is mainly given are either something with respect to preferences, that women prefer to work in things that are more about the home or more about nurturing, or some form of, you know, this is what they've always known, this is what is easy for them to do, or it might help them with balancing out home and taking care of kids, for example. Our hypothesis is different from anything else that's been put forward, as we know. It's really about a very different mechanism through which women may prefer to go into sectors where other women are, simply because it allows them to gain the value that they could because they have to negotiate and collaborate with people in that sector. And doing so with other men imposes a very large cost on them.
Does this mean, though, that compared to men, female entrepreneurs are at a disadvantage?
Absolutely. For example, we look at manufacturing, and if you look at tailoring and food, those are absolutely the lowest value add and the lowest profit subsectors within manufacturing. And so women are clearly trading off higher profits for what we believe is the opportunity to just be able to work with other women and not have to deal with the difficulty of potential expropriation.
Ed, in this paper, you've created a model. It brings together these observations, this idea you have about why female entrepreneurs choose the businesses they do, links it to the impact of the rule of law. What's your thinking behind this model?
Our framework emphasizes the collaboration that is at the heart of much entrepreneurship. Collaboration with co-producers, collaboration with financiers, collaboration with customers, and the need for trust. And in a sense, entrepreneurship is just one element in the urbanization of the world, all of which is about collaboration, right? So what the whole reason why cities exist is to enable human beings to work together with one another. And when you think about the urbanization of the poor world, its advantages will only be fully realized if all urbanites are able to engage in beneficial transactions with as many people as possible. Now, in our model, entrepreneurs, if they choose to become entrepreneurs, have a chance to collaborate with another worker and fulfill an order. We had in mind perhaps doing a tailoring job or creating some form of food product for a catering job. And when they engage in this collaboration, they first engage in ex-ante bargaining, and then ex-post, their partner may choose to behave badly, to try and expropriate them, to be lazy, to not fulfill their side of the bargain. And so there are two places at which any entrepreneur can get harmed by their partner, one of which is the partner may, you know, charge them too much ex ante. The partner may use the existing gender norms to squeeze every penny out of the transaction. Or secondly, the partner may give them a good deal, but then walk away from it, abuse them, steal their equipment. Who knows, right? And so there are two potential ways for things to break down. Now, rule of law protects you against the latter part. So if you have easy contracts, if you're able to call on police to protect you from a collaborator who's stolen your sewing machine, then, you know, you can at least protect yourself against the second form of expropriation. But unless you have also protection at the front end, you know, so you have a rule of law in a society that's highly gender normed, right? Highly oriented towards men getting the surplus. Why become an entrepreneur? Because the male that you bargain with will extract all of the surplus from the beginning. So it really highlights sort of an O-ring, if you will, element of entrepreneurship. You need both some sort of gender neutrality in terms of the norms in order to get a good deal ex ante. And then ex post, you need something like rule of law to protect you from expropriation once you're already in the deal. If you don't have that, you're really pretty much stuck with dealing with other women, right? Because otherwise the male advantage, either in legal institutions or in just violence, means that you will not be able to fully realize the returns to your entrepreneurship.
And you're testing this model using cross-national data. Where do you get the sort of data that you can use to test this?
There's several data sets we bring together in order to be able to look at this. We look at the World Bank Enterprise Survey that helps us define female entrepreneurship as the share of businesses with the majority of female owners. And then for the strength of the rule of law, we use the World Bank's Rule of Law Index. And then, you know, the hardest one, obviously, to measure in many ways is gender norms and female bargaining. There we use the Social Institutions and Gender Index that tells us about discrimination in the family, which is based on laws on child marriage, household responsibilities, inheritance, and divorce. But what's great also is that there is a world value survey from all over the world that asks, for example, whether it's acceptable for men to beat the wife or whether men make better business leaders. So it gives you a sense of the norms for women and for violence against women in these countries.
And you put all this together. Does it support your hypothesis?
Yes. I mean, in particular, we find that there is much more female entry into male-dominated industries in countries that have better rule of law, in countries where there is less discrimination against women, and especially in countries that have both.
It's the both that really seemed the striking fact to us. Mm-hmm. It's the fact, unless you have both relatively equal gender norms and as measured by these longstanding cultural traits and decent rule of law, then female entrepreneurship is very low. The gap's really quite large.
So just to give you a sense, like in countries where there's weak rule of law and gender norms are not equitable, you get about 16% of entrepreneurs being women. If you increase the share where there's strong rule of law, you get the increase to a share of 18%. And then if you increase just gender norms being equitable, but you keep rule of law weak, you get to 24%. But if you put the two together, so strong rule of law and equitable gender norms, you get 36% of entrepreneurs being women.
Now, you also tested this by surveying entrepreneurs in Zambia, didn't you? In Zambia, what sectors are women tending to choose?
So again, we look at manufacturing here, and we've got, you know, mainly tailoring and food production.
And you found that their choice, this has affected their income?
Yeah, so these are the lowest profit ones. So, you know, in going into manufacturing as a whole, I mean, part of the reason we chose manufacturing to look at was because, as Ed was describing, you know, what we're really interested in is the kind of collaboration that allows entrepreneurs to grow. And in manufacturing, you have these economies of scale that where collaboration can make a big difference. And the types of expropriation that Ed was describing that we talk about in the model are really at work. And, you know, you get the 27% of the manufacturers in Lusaka are women, and 75% of those are making apparel. Those are significantly lower profits per week and per month, including the variation in other subsectors.
We found that almost all of the gap in earnings between male and female entrepreneurs could be explained by female selection into those low-paying industries.
And we're sure that the mechanism that you described here is working in Lusaka.
The surest thing to ask an academic. We can give you a percent sure.
Put it this way. Do you think that the mechanism you described is working in Lusaka?
We do. And, you know, in some sense, the model was inspired by Nava's own experiences working with female entrepreneurs in Zambia. But also, we also ran an experiment where we tried to introduce rule of law and saw that, in fact, women were disproportionately impacted by it.
I had been working in other fields where I started to have a lot of qualitative interviews with these female entrepreneurs, asking them, you know, what got them interested in entrepreneurship? What were the biggest barriers they faced? And they would describe these challenges, the challenges of needing to bring a husband or a brother or someone someone to be able to get a loan or to make sure that they got paid back for some investment that they made, or to make sure that, you know, when they were given some order, that the person came to pick it up and paid for them for it, even though they had put so much work into it. And the difficulty of having to face the potential of violence and the potential of sexual exploitation in exchange for commerce. And seeing those challenges, we asked ourselves, like, what are the things that would actually shift that? And why is there this deep, low level of trust, which seems to be justified to some degree in this environment? Is there anything that would shift that? And so what we ended up doing to begin was a lab in the field experiment. So in all the markets in Lusaka, where there's lots and lots of entrepreneurs working in close quarters together, we worked with them to design a game that would approximate their real life experience of investment and growth of a business. And so we did a standard investment game, which is a trust game where one person gets, let's say, $10. They can invest some in a business that's going to have a return, and it's going to be multiplied by 3, and then it will be sent back. And we replicate the world values result that the trust among women in general is very low, on female entrepreneurs is very low in Zambia. But then what we do is we randomly assign them to opportunities to be able to have access to improved rule of law. And we give 2 local solutions to improvements in rule of law. One is working with a market chief, but making it anonymous so that the market chief doesn't know who's asking, but can arbitrate if they feel that they've got an unfair deal or if the person didn't fulfill their promise. And the other is using a small claims court. And what we find is that when women have randomly assigned access to these improved legal institutions, they are willing to trust more and to give more. And of course, through the logic of increased returns, that actually makes the pie bigger for everyone. And they then also receive back more. And so on both sides, there are greater profits to be had. So we have the cross-country survey results. We have some data results showing things like proximity to the market chiefs or proximity to the small claims court. And then we wanted to go one level deeper in terms of exogenous variation. And so we designed our own experiment to approximate this experience for female entrepreneurs and find that it indeed appears to enlarge the opportunities available to both female and male entrepreneurs that come from allowing women to be in an environment that allows them to trust more.
You seem to have identified something that is not only very important, but it is also universal here. So what can we do about this in Policy Solutions? I often ask people on these podcasts, if you were a policymaker for a day, what would you do? It sounds like it's going to take a bit more than a day.
The cultural norms are obviously not an easy thing to change. I mean, that's a decades or century thing. But rule of law can be changed quickly. We're making the point that simple tools to enable contract enforcement, simple tools like these market chiefs to make sure that a woman who's working in this area has access to someone who will take her claim seriously and who will enforce the deals that she makes, that we think can potentially have large impacts.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting also when you think about how does a low-trust society become a high-trust society? Mm. What does that take? And what does it take for someone who believes that most people can't be trusted to become someone who starts to trust more and therefore can increase the potential for economic growth of their community? And the opportunity to have an external force helping to enforce the contracts allows women to take these risks. They then can actually even experiment with, you know, maybe they've had 1 or 2 bad experiences, so they're not willing to take the risk to know whether other people could be trusted, even in absence of the institutions. So the idea that you could improve the institutions, even incrementally, and allow the behavior to change, which then allows the beliefs about trust to change, which then would potentially change norms as well. Obviously, in terms of gender norms, the more women start changing this behavior, the more that the gender norms themselves can change because it becomes much more normal for women to be around and for women to be identified with the kind of strength that comes with having a legal force behind you. You know, a lot of the women talk to me about how they just feel like they can't go forward to ask the men for the things that the men had contracted to do, for example, or if they're a boss for their employee that started stealing from them, for example. When they know that there's a legal force behind them, whether that's a market chief or a small claims court, they act differently and then they're seen differently. And I think that in itself could lead to a positive virtuous cycle with gender norms.
So, Tim, if you take our model seriously, you need both bargaining power up front and rule of law ex post. And I think you should ask Nava about her work on women in bargaining, which she's been doing over many years and knows as much about as anyone in the world. But in terms of the ex post law, I think part of the key thing is to get yourself out of longstanding historical cultural mindset on this, which unquestionably is true, right? I mean, we can talk about the arc of the common law going back to Henry II and the use of juries to establish the allocation of land before the war between Stephen and Matilda, right? We can talk about how, you know, it evolved over centuries. But the truth of the matter is you can also impose a legal institution which can be low cost and effective without changing everything about the country's legal institutions, which can be enforced just by expulsion from the market, right? You basically are asking people to fundamentally post a bond by paying to get entry into the market or by locating there. And that can work, maybe not as perfectly as the full majesty of the common law, but it can get you some of the way there. So don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We can design low-cost, high rule of law environments for budding entrepreneurs in the developing world without actually changing everything about society. And that, in fact, can be, in some sense, the thin end of the wedge that can push that broader social change.
Nava, I'm going to take Ed's advice. I'm going to ask you about women in bargaining.
Yes. I just don't know where to start, Tim. There's so much to be said about this. So there's a few things. One is the more general descriptive that women, especially if they're doing zero-sum type games, like if I'm bargaining for a price, for example, on average, women tend to be not as good in this. And partly that's because of the backlash of being perceived as aggressive, for example, and therefore not being willing to try to ask for that. I mean, in the developing world, I also think it's partly because of this fear of retribution through violence. So I taught negotiation at Harvard Business School, and there was always this challenge with how do we think about women in negotiation and getting women to negotiate more, but also without having to face the backlash that also they're facing the developed world in asking for more. And this became even more important to do in a Zambian culture where the social fabric is super important. And so what we did was to adapt the Harvard negotiation curriculum for young women in Zambia. So these are 12, 13-year-olds that we taught to negotiate through a lens of how do you increase the pie for everyone. And it turns out also from the overall literature in bargaining for women, that women are very good at that, at being able to bargain for other people and find a way to make the pie bigger for everyone. Let's go back to entrepreneurship and manufacturing. What is that about? It is really about generating economies of scale and creating a bigger pie for everyone. And so in that sense, there is an enormous talent and potential that we could unlock in women. And what we found in the example with the Zambian girls was that randomly assigning them to a 6-week course in this type of negotiation skills increased their human capital investment, increased the rate of graduation from high school. We're now looking at, you know, their entrepreneurship rates and their business rates. But this is something where it's a particular skill that can try to make sense of the environment. Now, this is most useful with people who you are going to have a long-term relationship with. If you think about our context, the context of the female entrepreneurs, this is also often a more repeated setting, but I wonder to what extent, and Ed, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this too, as we think about the kinds of collaborations that women have, to what extent we want to think about skills versus institutions and how much these are substitutes versus complements is a bigger question that we've been thinking about. Because when we think about the question of female empowerment, the advice is lean in, right? The advice is like train yourself up. And the flip side of that is that it puts a lot of the responsibility on the women themselves versus what we're suggesting in this paper, which is much more about an institutional or a systemic change. And I do think that these two things can be complements. One way to look at them is that the negotiation skills help you to design the contract so that it's the best possible contract. And the legal institutions give you the security to know that the contract will actually be implemented and that you don't need to be afraid to, for example, share information of the kind that will help you have the greatest gains from trade because you won't be taken advantage of.
You know, one of the most striking facts, actually, is that women learn their trade in formal institutions rather than from other entrepreneurs, either family members or just random people, which suggests in some sense that this traditional role of cities as being places where ideas flit from place to place, in Alfred Marshall's words, the mysteries of the trade become no mystery, but are, as it were, in the air, that traditional function of cities may be failing women because they're unable to engage in partnerships of trust with existing entrepreneurs. To me, at least, that highlights the incredible importance of formal training for female entrepreneurs, and that you really do need both? Do you really do need institutions that enable them to protect themselves from expropriation and the contract? You need bargaining skills ex ante to enable them to write a good contract. And you need the skills to be able to do things that are valued by other people in the market. So I think all of these things are necessary. But the fact that you can't get them all right exactly first doesn't mean that you shouldn't get started, because there's, you know, the time to act on this now, and you really need to, you know, start working on whatever it is that you can do in the moment.
Yes, on just that point, especially given what Ed was saying earlier in terms of not making the best the enemy of the good and starting with local institutions, you know, because we often think, okay, how do you improve the rule of law in a whole country? I think one of the key things that came out of our paper was the importance of sort of bringing these legal institutions towards the entrepreneurs themselves. So both for the market chiefs and for the small claims court, for example, on the small claims court, women often didn't know about it. They often feel like it's not for them. They don't have access to it. So really providing that type of on-the-ground access. And the market chiefs, of course, provide that. But one of the keys for our experiment was to make sure that they were unbiased, so they were doing it anonymously. And that's the challenge with using sort of individuals, is that they can be often biased themselves. And so the key is to find ways to bring legal institutions to people rather than having them be somewhere that they think is for someone else. But then in doing that, ensure that the channel itself isn't biased in the way the society is biased.
Well, this is fascinating research and has a benefit, not just because it's the right thing to do, but it also has a benefit in terms of growth and poverty reduction and equality. So thank you very much for talking to us about it today. Ed, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
And Nava, somewhere outside Vancouver, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
Nava, you are on the road, yeah, but you're not driving, are you?
No, of course not.
The paper we've been talking about is called Rule of Law and Female Entrepreneurship. It is NBER Working Paper 26366, if you want to find it that way. And the authors are Nava Ashraf, Alexia Delfino, who couldn't be with us today, but she probably wouldn't have got a word in anyway, and Ed Glaser. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform. That means you'll never miss an episode. And remember, you can always find past episodes at voxdev.org.